Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Carlos Frias. You're going to want to grab your virtual reality goggles for this hour of radio because the filmmaker Rodney Asher is taking us into the Matrix.
Do you believe in fate, Neo?
No.
Why not?
Because I don't like the idea that I'm not in control of my life.
No, not the movie with Keanu Reeves. Rodney has made a movie about the real Matrix, so to speak. Rodney's documentary, A Glitch in the Matrix, explores the question, are we living in a simulation?
We are living in a computer-programmed reality.
Simulation theory is the idea that this is all fake.
The Matrix was real.
We are being inhabited by some sort of player. I would start giving myself tests. I'm thinking of someone and I turn the corner and there they are.
The only clue we have is when some alteration in our reality occurs.
Laugh if you want, but don't look away. Rodney interviews people in his film who fear, or hope, that the world they're living in is not exactly real. He doesn't just talk to conspiracy theorists. There's an Oxford professor, a Harvard engineer, and a pastor. Rodney's movie looks at the lives of people who truly believe they might be living in a simulated world, and the dark side of buying into it. Rodney's documentaries like to push the audience. His critically acclaimed film, Room 237, interviewed people who look for hidden messages in Stanley Kubrick's movie, The Shining. He looks critically at the unexplained, and at the people who hold on to these beliefs. Not without a splash of humor. His film is playing on Saturday at the Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami, but before then, he offers us the blue or red pill. Welcome, Rodney.
Hey, thanks for all that. Great to talk to you, Carlos.
Yeah, no, it's great to be able to talk with you about this movie. And our buddy Renee over at the Cosford is screening it, and I'm excited to see it on the big screen after seeing it on the tiny little screen of my computer.
Me too. You know, I actually have not seen this movie on a big screen. When we premiered at Sundance, it was still during lockdown. So that was, you know, all virtual, all on TVs and laptops and iPads. And this will be my first time seeing it with an audience. So I'm really looking forward to that, especially for the soundtrack.
Yeah, no, the soundtrack, before we get into the film itself, the soundtrack, tell me about the creation of it. Cause I think I read David Diggs was part of creating the soundtrack or.
No, not exactly. Jonathan Snipes is the composer and also the sound designer. He happens to have a pretty amazing experimental hip-hop band David does the vocals for.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah, Jonathan and his partner Bill.
So that's great. It's going to be a fully immersive experience. I'm looking forward to seeing it on the big screen. So talk to me about what sparked your interest for looking into this subject.
Well, it's a pretty natural subject for me. I mean, these last series of projects have all been about the way that fiction, and in particular genre fiction, horror, science fiction, fantasy, either sort of gives us language to talk about some pretty unusual psychological, philosophical ideas, but sometimes seem to cross over the border into reality. And, you know, when I discovered that the idea of a digitally simulated reality, kind of like the Matrix, was something that people were taking seriously as a, you know, plausible scientific notion, you know, I just had to know more.
You know, when I first heard the idea of simulation theory, I thought of the endings of some of the memorable shows, like the ending of Newhart and recently the ending of Atlanta, where they're like, was that all a dream? Was that all a simulation? That kind of idea. But explain to us the theory behind simulation theory, which is kind of at the heart of your documentary.
Yeah, well, it can get super complicated really quickly.
Okay, don't give us that version.
Well, and I might not even be the most qualified person to do that. But the big picture idea is that this world might be, you know, that we might be living in something sort of like a gigantic, interconnected, multiplayer video game inside of an incredibly sophisticated computer someplace. In fact, Nick Bostrom, Oxford professor, he wrote a paper on the subject, I think this was early 2000s, And he came at it from a mathematical direction, among other ways.
Like,
and sort of tried to.
Does the math say that this could exist, kind of thing?
Yeah, like how much computer processing power would it take to create a fully realistic universe? And, you know, is that plausible with what we know about physics and things? And, you know, very quickly the math is miles away from what I was able to understand. But what I took away from it was the idea that people considerably smarter than me thought the notion was possible.
So was there something in your life that where you came across this idea and said, you know, I got to make a film about this, or I got to investigate whether there is a film here?
Well, it was a combination of reading about the idea and kind of boring into what that means, then discovering story after story after story. A lot of them are on these sort of internet threads that read like kind of true life Twilight Zone stories, where people experience sort of inexplicable events that lead them to believe that we're living in a simulation. But then there are sort of milestones as the idea continued to get mainstreamed, right? There was, you know, after Bostrom's article, it started to get picked up by some major news outlets. You know, there was a long article about it in The New Yorker and in like The Guardian. And Elon Musk started talking about it at these like tech forums. So the idea started to ripple out, you know, into culture. And, you know, very quickly, you know, I just fell into the rabbit hole.
Yeah, and you go way down into it. You spent a year conducting interviews with different people. Tell me about some of the folks that you eventually settled on and whose stories you started telling.
Yeah, well, there's sort of four or five kind of, I call them eyewitnesses, people who have gone through something or other that have left them, you know, with this belief. You know, one of them, Paul, is a performer and a tech guy. And he's had a feeling along those lines that went back to his, you know, sort of early childhood and this kind of uncanny experience he had at a church. And like Paul, there was another character who sort of, he was in a, and this is, you know, I always see these things in terms of genre films, but there was a guy who, after experiencing one just sort of baffling coincidence after another, after another, after another, went into, took an experience in a sensory deprivation tank, like in altered states. And then he had this revelation about the nature of reality. The other two people are folks who kind of came to it more through sort of deductive reasoning, that the only explanation for what they went through that made sense, right, was the idea that they were living in a simulation. It's interesting to me that they kind of came to this conclusion from radically different directions.
Yeah, so one guy in church, one guy sitting in what? Basically a tank where he's floating in water, where he's closed off from sounds from the world around him. Was there a commonality? Because you eventually, from what I understand, you talked to dozens and dozens of people and tried to whittle down to four stories that made sense to tell. Tell me, is there a commonality between those folks that you highlighted in your film?
Not a super strong one that I'm able to draw any sweeping conclusion from.
Sure.
You know, they have all gone through, you know, sort of dramatic, emotional, unusual experiences that had left them searching for answers. But I mean, that's probably describes most everybody.
Yeah. There's definitely, they talk about different things that happen in their lives. One character, you know, one, I call him character, but talks about leaving home really early and the expectation that he should leave home, kind of living on his own. Speaking of characters, I think of them as characters because you did something interesting in the film where you kind of hid their identities. In other words, you used their name, but their images, it was all done via Zoom, these Zoom interviews, and their images are kind of like, I guess you would call them like Snapchat filters, right? They're like avatars for who they are. Tell me about and why you decided that.
Yeah, well, they're explicitly avatars. And one thing I love about that notion is that, sure, an avatar is what we use, is the word that we use to talk about video game characters, but it's also like in Eastern traditions, right? The form that someone, a god, perhaps from another reality, takes in order to walk amongst us. And if you think about video games in the same way, those characters are what we use in order to interact with those virtual worlds. So that parallel, you know, was something that I was, you know, thinking of and playing with throughout the, you know, throughout the experience. And it just seemed like an interesting way to talk about sort of the future of communication, right? Like all the interviews were done, you know, via web chats, in that as our life is becoming increasingly mediated by electronics and people are customizing the way, like even like the little, you know, we all use little thumbnail avatars for, you know, our social media accounts or our text accounts. And sometimes it's a picture of us. Sometimes it's a character that we borrowed from, you know, our favorite movie or TV show. Sometimes it's a cartoon character. That the idea that that might become in the near future sort of the primary way that we present ourselves. And it also gave me sort of an interesting way of, because a big part of the film is, you know, dramatizing these experiences that we had, and we were always going to do that, you know, with digital animation, by using these digital characters within the interview sequences, we can then have exactly that same character living out the experiences that we build for them. And what's kind of interesting is, in those experiences, they fit in perfectly, right? It's like that's the environment that they were built for. There's also maybe kind of a fun for me notion of, in a way, we're talking to video game characters on their day off back in their apartments afterwards.
right after they've logged
off.
And
it's always fun. Yeah, and it's always fun for me to see sort of genre characters who drop their who drop out of character, even like in the Warner Brothers cartoon where the coyote and the sheepdog clock out and make small talk in the coffee room before going back to chasing each other off of cliffs.
Right, exactly, where they check out of their jobs. I'm curious about, when you talk to these folks, did you get a sense for them that even as they were talking with you, that they felt like they were all in some kind of scripted thing? Like, did they believe you were a non-playing character? Or
that was a joke that came up now and again. But for the most part, you know, these were just interesting, casual, you know, sort of long, sprawling conversations.
And so how do you take something like that, where you work on something for a year and then try to make sense of it? How did you go about trying to decide what you wanted to say with the film?
Well, what I typically do, you know, this is the sort of third or fourth one of these that I've done, is I know what the subject is, but I don't come into this with a real agenda or preconceived ideas, right? I want to tell the story that I want to tell these people's stories. So the process is more about finding folks who come at the subject from interesting angles. And then what we do is break down a 2 or 3 hour conversation into a handful of sort of self-contained 3-minute little monologues that are on a particular subject. And I have a system where each one of those get written on a different colored post-it note, or each character gets their own colored post-it note. And to sort of get an overview of the flow of the entire movie, we then start juggling those post-it notes into collections of scenes where we move from one character to another, and then those scenes together into longer sequences before ultimately you can pull back all the way and get the film. And I mean, I'm always surprised and sort of excited that these go into directions that I wouldn't have been capable of writing from scratch at the top of this. You know, even little moments like Paul talks about his being at a backyard barbecue with his uncle, who tells him, well, if this world's a simulation, what keeps me from, you know, just going next door and shooting my neighbor? And he's like, is that what you want to do? What you think you could do? What you think you would do if you didn't believe that there were consequences? And that notion in that little, in the drama of that little moment, is something I never would have imagined. But, you know, Paul talking about that experience with his uncle, I thought was a really dramatic, emotional, you know, kind of little bit. So that's always for me the fun of this, is, you know, not seeing this as something I'm writing, but as stories that I collect and present.
Yeah, that was one moment that for me also stood out. And there is a point where the movie takes a little bit of a dark turn, but I want to give us more room to talk about that and take a little break here. Our guest today is Rodney Asher. He's a filmmaker, and his new movie, A Glitch in the Matrix, is playing at the Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami on Saturday. We'll take a break and be back in a second with Rodney. We're back with Rodney Asher, the filmmaker of the movie A Glitch in the Matrix, back on Sundial. This is Carlos Frias. I misspoke a second ago. I said the movie just came out. It came out in 2021 in the heart of the pandemic. And I'm curious whether the making of the film kind of lent itself to that, like the fact that the pandemic had us all stored in our homes and you had to do a lot of the recording via Zoom. That was that by design, or that was just like a confluence that worked out well?
No, it was a very strange coincidence, though there is something about these projects seeming to generate coincidences as I go, that, you know, I had made the decision to do the recordings virtual just because it seemed to be on theme. But then, you know, as we were finishing, the pandemic hit. In fact, you know, one of our lead animators, Lorenzo, was working in Italy while we were finishing up, and they got shut down first. So it's like I experienced the pandemic first, you know, via his reporting from overseas, and then watched it march, you know, across the ocean out here to LA. And then, you know, strangely, you know, shortly after the film, Zoom interviews became, you know, kind of part of our more common visual language. I mean, there was even a episode of 30 Rock that was all done on Zoom and Saturday Night Live.
And
but the fact that,
I was going to say, we're on Zoom today, which is, you know, we're all within the Matrix here today.
We're all communicating, you know, in through the world of electronics. But, you know, maybe there's something strange and, you know, a little ironic that using those video game like avatars in our Zoom conversations in some ways feels like a satire of, you know, all the Zoom conversations that we've seen that we've seen since then. But, you know, that's how we did it before this whole thing happened. If it was a satire, it was a preemptive one.
Right. You know, I wanted to talk to you a little bit more about those dark moments in the movie, you know, because there are parts where, you know, you think, okay, if we are living in a simulation, people truly believe that, then what are some of those consequences? And you get into one very specific one regarding a man named Joshua Cook. Will you talk about what it was like to talk to him and kind of recap a little bit about what his experience is in the film?
Sure, you know, and fair enough. But Joshua was someone that we found because as I was researching simulation theory, I came across an idea that, you know, was just truly jaw-dropping, which is that there have been a number of criminal trials where people have used what's been come to be known as the Matrix defense, which is a sort of, you know, variation of the insanity defense. It's the idea that you've committed this crime while you were under the belief that this world wasn't real, and therefore, you know, you thought that what you were doing didn't really have consequences. And there are a half dozen folks, you know, who've used it. And Joshua Cook, well, his defense attorneys wanted to use it, but at a certain point, he decided to plead guilty.
He was convicted of shooting his adoptive parents in the film.
That's right. You know, and he's somebody who he came to believe that he was living in something like the Matrix, though. There were headlines and news articles, you know, that wanted to say that said things like the Matrix made me do it, which is an oversimplification. He was a young man who was going through a lot of things at the same time, you know, one real life, you know, stressor after another. And he was suffering from, you know, an undiagnosed mental illness that nobody had picked up. So his belief in the Matrix, you know, was intense, but it wasn't the only thing that was going on in his life.
Right.
But yeah, I certainly wanted to talk about the Matrix defense, and his story was a version of it that, you know, was incredibly charged. And, you know, he's somebody, I always prefer to talk to people who have skin in the game, mm-hmm. who have an emotional connection to what they're talking about, as opposed to, you know, it could have been a very dry conversation with a defense attorney or, you know, or a law school teacher about the ins and outs of the defense. But to talk to someone who went through it and, you know, came out the other side, you know, was what made a lot more sense to me.
Yeah, it's really surprising and gripping, you know, really a really shattering moment in the movie. And you do this interesting thing in the movie where, you know, you have to dramatize sections of it, obviously, because they're interviews and you're going back, and you show it kind of like a first person shooter type of perspective, and it's, I think it's really affecting. Talk to me about what you took away from that, from talking with these folks who, you know, you had a casual interest in, and then you, like you said, you go down the rabbit hole. What did you take away from it?
Well, it's hard for me to get, you know, one clear, you know, lesson or moral mm-hmm. from it. Certainly the notion that this world isn't entirely real feels like a brand new one, right? If you're talking about computers and virtual reality, you know, and the metaverse and things, it feels like, wow, this is the newest chain of events and way of thinking about things that has ever hit us. But it also goes back thousands of years, depending on, you know, how you want to look at it. From, you know, Philip K. Dick was writing about it in the 70s, back when computers, you know, were just spitting out punch cards and reel-to-reel magnetic tape. But you can go back, you know, considerably earlier to talk about Descartes' Meditations or Eastern philosophy, stories about the dream of the butterfly.
Yeah, there is a discussion of kind of how religion and the idea of past lives all help or all backstory for the potential of this, which I thought you did really, really cleverly in the movie, and kind of saying like the technology that we have dictates, you know, what we can envision for a way to explain this phenomenon that people feel.
Yeah, I mean, I think what I take away from it personally, but, you know, everyone is free to come away, you know, in their own way, mm-hmm. you know, is that however this world got here, right? Whether, you know, whether a bearded man in the sky said, "Let there be light," or whether, you know, a kid started up a new computer program, you know, on their PS100. This is probably the only world that we're going to be in. This is probably the only life that we're going to have, you know. So whatever, you know, is whatever is behind the curtain, and whatever is, you know, whatever the blueprints look like, you know, take it seriously and treat it with respect.
Did you find yourself looking at your own life and thinking, you know, trying to see the world through these guys' eyes? Like, I, you know, you were telling our producer before you came on about, you know, your son being a video game player, and you know, I'm sure that you've come across them in your life. But did you begin to kind of look for the seams yourself?
I don't know that I can that the seams are all that clear to me, though I do find it to be, you know, a very useful metaphor to talk about. And, you know, one that I like, and also I'd like sort of another way of thinking about the world as a game is, you know, considering things like fate and free will, that within a video game, you have a certain amount of freedom. But if you're in a game of Grand Theft Auto, or you're in a game of Major League Baseball, MLB's The Show, you can arguably do what you want, but you're still going to be guided down a pretty particular path. So it's maybe an interesting notion to take a step back and ask yourself, you know, what is the game that I'm in asking of me? What kind of path is it pushing me? And are those my only options? The thing about my son is interesting, because in some ways, you know, as you say, the film gets pretty dark, and some people could probably come away from it, you know, thinking that my idea of technology is pretty pessimistic. But at the same point, without technology, we never could have made the film. The film allowed me to collaborate with, you know, friends and coworkers who are literally some of them are across town and some of them are across the world. And when the pandemic hit, electronics were a lifeline to, you know, for our family. They're, you know, my son who was, you know, stuck in the house for weeks upon months, you know, and beyond, was able to, you know, reach out to his friends. And the games both had objectives for them to complete, but often they felt like a very real space where they could hang out and spend time together. So it's a double-edged sword. You know, it giveth and it taketh away.
Right. Ronnie, I want to transition a little bit in talking about the kind of guy who makes this kind of film and then these kinds of films.
Okay.
Because all your films, really, I think that, you know, I'm thinking of 237. They look at not exactly conspiracy, but maybe the unexplained, right? And let people kind of build stories there. So take me a little bit back to, you know, you're growing up. You're from South Florida. You moved to South Florida very young, right? And you went to school at UM Film School?
Yeah, that's right. My family moved to Florida from Boston when I was about 13. And, you know, I studied film and psychology at UM and stayed in Miami for, I don't know, maybe 7 or 8 years afterwards, spending a lot of time in Miami Beach in particular.
Tell me what Miami Beach was like when you were growing up there. Was this the sleepy South Beach of the 90s?
It was the South Beach like in the midst of great and, you know what, you know, from my eyes, like really exciting change. That Lincoln Road was still a place where, you know, you could ride your bike down Lincoln Road, and there was a pair of places on it that, you know, were really central to my orbit. There was both the Alliance Cinema, right tucked in right next to Books and Books, and then across the street there was above SAFAC, there was the Alliance Film Co-op, which, you know, had video, Super 8, and 16 millimeter classes. And me and my friends, Sid Garin, Trisha Golubev, Bill Orcutt, Baron Shearer, Mark Barswell, Ray Parla, Mike Morrison, Mark Holt, were all working together, pushing each other in different directions and coming at our projects from different perspectives that wound up, you know, sort of adding up to being more than their component parts. You know, there was, you know, an amazing nightlife scene. Like, we were really into, you know, alternative music, and we're spending a lot of time at places like the Kitchen Club or Club Beirut, Club New, the Cameo, which was having one amazing punk rock show after another, Churchill's Hideaway, Jonestown, the Institute. I mean, I remember opening night when Thomas Kramer might have only been open for one night, but he created this insane three-story satanic nightclub called Hell. It might have closed after opening night, but the amount of hype and overkill around that was, you know, fodder for, you know, for months of jokes.
Three stories
afterwards.
Of hell, one night only, right?
more or less.
So a lot of these folks then really influenced you as a person in your filmmaking, because I understand one of them worked on doing the graphics for Glitch in the Matrix.
Yeah, well, that was Sid Garin. We went to school together and have, you know, continued. We're still working together. You know, and his company Mindbomb took the charge on the animation and graphics on this one.
Were movies big for you growing up? Were they big in your house?
I'm sorry, you dropped out.
Were movies big in your house when you were growing up? Was yours a movie watching family?
Yeah, we spent a lot of. We actually went a lot to the drive-in. I know when we would visit my grandparents in New London, Connecticut, and sometimes we would see movies that are just really, you know, in hindsight, kind of unusual family drive-in movies, like All the President's Men or Orca.
I remember both of those. God, Orca, just terrifying on an outdoor big screen for a little kid.
it was terrifying. All the President's Men didn't hit quite so hard.
Yeah, then a giant killer whale leaping up and chasing people around the ocean. Was there? I'm curious because, like I said, 237 and the other film you made, the Nightmare, which talks about explores sleep paralysis. Like they all feel like they have a thread, you know. And I'm wondering, was there like a person in your life that really was like, I don't want to say the conspiracy theorist, but someone who was like teaching you to think a little differently?
I don't know. It comes from these projects are uniting a bunch of influences. I know my dad was always fascinated with the assassination of JFK. So that was maybe an early introduction to the world of conspiracy theory.
Yeah, I don't want to say bingo, but bingo.
Okay, well, you don't have to get too Freudian.
No, no. That's interesting because you begin to see a different side of like what you see as a different narrative, right?
Yeah, well, and although I think it's also pretty clear to both of us that, you know, from my days growing up with those stories to, you know, even the semi-recent past of 237 talking about like moon landing conspiracies, that conspiracy theories in the time since then have become much, much more politicized and loaded, you know, which is something that I can't help but notice, even if that's not really, you know, my central focus these days.
Did you worry that if you made a film like this, that it would become politicized, and then you would come down, you know, people would say, oh, he's the debunker or the evangelist of the simulation theory, and you know, that kind of thing?
No, I mean, I didn't give myself enough credit to think that I was ever going to be able to, for once and for all, either prove or debunk something like simulation theory, which is a bigger topic than I am. So, I mean, that's not something in particular I worried about. But I might say that another really inspirational big bang for where I'm coming from was like at UM. You know, I had two teachers in particular, George Capewell and Tony Allegro, who were in some ways the polar opposites, but both hit me in different sweet spots, where like George would take us in a frame at a time through like a scene in the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, largely both to talk about the suspense, but also like the effect of the telephoto lens to compress space and, you know, make it seem like Leatherface was just inches, you know, behind the woman that he was chasing through the woods. But in looking at a movie like that, you know, sort of intellectually was, you know, a revelation to me. And then at the same time, Tony Allegro, who was teaching experimental film, he showed the whole class, but I'm the one who, it really imprinted on me. Mm-hmm. He showed Bruce Conner's A Movie from the late 50s, you know, and it's an early collage film, right? All the shots are archival clips from newsreels and science fiction movies and cartoons and war films and genre films. And somehow by putting these into this new context, it started to tell this whole other story, something about the battle of the sexes, the meaning of life, creation, destruction, life and death. And being able to see that through this new combination of existing films, especially that, you know, what I especially liked is a lot of them, you know, were kind of disposable, goofy genre films that, you know, I almost immediately started cutting together compilations from, you know, my personal VHS collection at my work study job at the law school video department. And that was actually where I first started to feel like I was creating something that I was proud of, that felt like self-expression and not just a class exercise. And clearly 237, you know, there's those 7 minutes of conspiracy theory about the moon landing, but in the big picture, it's a collage film. And a lot of that is still, you know, part of the chain reaction that started in class watching Bruce Conner movies.
You mentioned this VHS collection. What were some of the movies that you had in your collection? What kind of things were you watching? What kind of things were kind of grabbing your attention?
Well, it was, you know, it's a combination of things, you know, and these, it's probably still, you know, the kind of influences that I'm drawing from. And they're, you know, it's the sort of polar ends of trash and art of there was like a San Francisco robotic performance group called Survival Research Laboratories. And I would have, and I had a few tapes of their performances, but, you know, I was also using movies from the 50s that were sort of trade show movies of like the cars of the future in these, you know, amazing Technicolor landscapes, and Evel Knievel compilations, horror movies and art movies. You know, I tend to gravitate to the high and the low, and while avoiding the middle as best I can.
There definitely feels to like an Andy Warhol effect there too, like kind of like when you mentioned trash specifically, like trying to make art where other people aren't looking, so to speak.
Yeah, well, there's an amazing notion that I got. There's a Philip K. Dick line that actually the Weird Studies podcast did a whole episode just about this phrase, where he was writing about a character talked about. He said something like, "The symbols of the divine first make themselves known in the trash stratum." And this is, you know, you think about this geologically, you know, there's the different levels of rocks and earth from different periods. And then, you know, a layer of trash from different cultures. And he was talking specifically about like finding words or phrases that were meaningful, like literally in the trash, like, you know, in the gum wrappers and cigarette boxes on the sidewalk. But also just thinking of the way that ideas are first introduced into society from, you know, the lower arts, from comic books, which I still love, from genre films, you know, and like you think about the superhero movie explosion of today, of the last decade plus, is coming from, you know, what was disposable pop culture, you know, from that really peaked in the 1960s. Yeah. Though it also has deep meaning embedded in it, because that first wave of Marvel characters is, a lot of it is inspired from the Atomic Age, you know, which is a, you know, a globally shattering, you know, event, you know, that we're still living through the repercussions of.
Right. And I want to talk about more about your influences, but first I have to take a little break. We're speaking with Rodney Asher, who's a filmmaker, and his documentary, A Glitch in the Matrix, is playing at the Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami on Saturday. Be back in 1 minute on Sundial. We're back on Sundial. This is Carlos Frias, and our guest today is Rodney Asher, the filmmaker. His new film is A Glitch in the Matrix. It's playing at the Cosford Cinema on Saturday. Rodney, so you were talking about some, you know, kind of some of the pop culture influences, right? And you can say that your film literally just, it does grab this piece of like this idea of Reddit threads, this thing that exists, and kind of exposing it and bringing it to light and exploring it. Can you talk to me about some of your own influences coming up, like the things you've mentioned, comic books, you mentioned the Atomic Age, you know, those ideas floating in the background, and Stanley Kubrick, who Rene Rodriguez has always tells me is the greatest filmmaker of all time.
Yeah, well, he's a pretty big one, and it's hard to, you know, overestimate his influence. You know, you mentioned Andy Warhol, and you know, for me, that's kind of the dawn of art that really, you know, strikes me with a lightning bolt. You know, I remember there was an amazing retrospective of his, I think it was at the San Francisco MoMA maybe. And, you know, I just had to, you know, midway through, I just had to go into the bathroom and splash water in my face to try to calm down. I was really overwhelmed by it.
What was it? What was it that struck you? Can you try to enunciate it now that you've had some time to think about it all these years?
I don't know. I think it was just the work was so beautiful and there was so much of it. You know, it was like I could feel the time like moving through him. Like there was an artist at the Alliance at the same time that, you know, that I was there, who was making these Super 8 movies, and they were just exquisite, and they reminded me a lot of, you know, sort of 60s experimental filmmakers like Paul Sheritz, you know, that it's very like these animated Jackson Pollock, you know, kind of expressions. And he would do them on Super 8, which, you know, is literally an 8 millimeter little square, And he would paint, you know, one image after another after another on them painstakingly. And he must have needed a jeweler's loop to do it. And when you would just watch like a 3 or 4 minute, you know, kind of passage of them, I would just feel the seconds, minutes, hours, days, weeks, months of his life that were all concentrated in, you know, every 18th of a second frame that were blowing, that were flying past. And you know, that could be kind of overwhelming. That could be kind of overwhelming too.
Yeah. Have you thought about how these different folks and their really intensive filmmaking techniques, how that helped influence your own style?
Yeah, I don't know that it's ever something that I've totally intellectualized. I mean, Stanley Kubrick, you know, has an amazing aesthetic, right? Where every frame of his films, every shot, you know, looks like a painting, like a really beautifully balanced composition. You know, and that's certainly something that I aim for, you know, when I'm filming or designing an animation. But there's also, like in his work, an attitude, kind of a wise guy, anti-establishment kind of attitude that is leaking through everything else that's happening. And in a way, I don't know, when you see a film by someone who in some ways maybe you share an attitude with, that you feel this connection, right? You know, I know when I was talking to the people in room 237, I was kind of struck that each of them felt like they had a one-on-one relationship with him too. There was one of the people we talked to, you know, was a journalist, and he said Stanley Kubrick is a great journalist. And you know, talking to my composer, and he's like, Stanley Kubrick had a amazing taste in music, and everybody was seeing a reflection of their own interest in the film and in his greater work. You know, and I think, you know, almost any, you know, film, movie, piece of music, book that really strikes a chord with people, that it, at the base of that may be, this is someone who sees the world the same way I do. And, you know, it's hard to overestimate the power of that.
Right. And there's an element of that in your new movie, too, in A Glitch in the Matrix, because, you know, all these characters do feel like they saw something specific, you know, that spoke directly to them, that they were living in a simulation, that idea, that kind of singular person making a discovery kind of thing, that I think you do a really great job at kind of revealing and letting this person reveal themselves. Can you talk a little bit more about 237? Because that was like such a big hit, that kind of, I did that open the door to do more of these, you know, do other things, more movies like this?
Oh yeah, in an incredibly clear in concrete way, that 237 was a film that me and my friend Tim Kirk made for next to nothing, you know, and never expected, you know, to break out. In my notion, I was sure that we were doing an underground movie that would play, you know, at a handful of micro cinemas, you know, with 25 seats of like of folding metal chairs. And when it kind of blew up, among, you know, the other among the other, you know, really amazing things about it was that it allowed me to make the next one, you know, that you make a film that plays Sundance and gets released, you go on, you know, what they call a water bottle tour, where different producers will invite you to, you know, come sit down. They give you a bottle of water from their fridge, and then talk about your film, what they're doing, what you want to do. And if you meet, you know, 30 or 40 of them, you might do a project with one of them. But in a very real way, that movie opened those doors and made it easy for me to do The Nightmare, which, you know, was a movie that we didn't do for nothing, that there was a producer, there was a crew, there was a budget, there was, you know, a planned release, a release plan in place for, you know, 237 was something that, you know, there wasn't anybody waiting for us to finish that one.
And The Nightmare, you also hit a kind of another kind of interesting topic that is off the beaten path, which is this idea of sleep paralysis. And I know because my producer and I, we have both experienced that, and it is terrifying. Was it a personal experience of yours that that led you to that? This idea that just to give some background, that your eyes wake up, you wake up, but your body is not yet caught up with you and woken up with you. So you kind of wake up in the middle of the nightmare or in the middle of the dream. Can you talk about any kind of personal experience that led to that?
Yeah, I had one, you know, really striking one. And I had the experience a lot the way you're talking about it. I woke up and I wasn't able to move. But like a lot of people, I saw these sort of shadowy figures moving around me. And at the time, I had never heard of sleep paralysis. And I didn't think that I was having, you know, I didn't think I was having something related to a dream. I thought I was seeing something related to a ghost.
I had the same experience as that.
It's so much more common, you know, than anybody thinks. And I remember whenever I would bring it up in conversation, if I was talking to, you know, more than three or four people, there'd always be one person who was like, oh my God, that happened to me. So in a way, it's a film very much like 237 and Glitch, where, you know, 237 is not a documentary about the making of The Shining. It's about people struggling to understand what it meant. Mm-hmm. And Glitch in the Matrix isn't a movie investigating the science of simulation theory. It's talking to people who believe in it and getting their personal stories. So The Nightmare is very much a collection of first person stories of people who have gone through it and have struggled to figure out what that means. And, you know, it's an easy thing to find, like these other topics, you know, online, you know, hundreds of stories of people experiencing it and seeing these shadowy figures and wondering whether they're experiencing something supernatural or if it's just a dream. You know, so it very naturally felt like it shared ideas and tableaus with horror movies. So, you know, among other reasons, if Glitch looks like is a computer animated science fiction movie in a way, you know, The Nightmare is a ghost story, is a horror movie.
And I think all your movies share a little bit of that, this people who all realize that they all have this hidden shared experience. And then there's kind of an aha to it. Listen, in the last less than a minute that we have left, after making this film, give me your personal thoughts on simulation theory. Have your opinions evolved or changed at all from when you first started looking into it to when you look at it now?
Well, I never thought that I was going to figure it out for once and for all, and I still haven't figured it out. But again, my notion is, at the end of the day, it is just another creation myth. And this world, unless there's some technological breakthrough happening sometime very, very quickly that I'm personally skeptical of, we're never going to find out definitively. So treat this world like the only one you're going to get.
Oof, that's great advice. Rodney, thank you so much for making the time.
Oh, it was great to talk to you. Thank you, Carlos.
We spoke with Rodney Asher. He's a filmmaker, and his new documentary, published in or coming out in 2021, was A Glitch in the Matrix, but it is playing for one night, Saturday, April 1st, at the Cosford Cinema at the University of Miami. And that's Sundial for Wednesday, March 30th. Leslie Ovalle-Atkinson is our lead producer. Elisa Baena is our producer and social media editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's VP of News, and Katie Munoz is our director of live programming. Peter J. Meritz is WLRN's vice president of radio and Sundial's engineer. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Balo. And you can download a podcast of this program. Just search for WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Coming up next week on the program, the Frost Museum of Science is introducing new paleontology research. The curator leading it will join us in our studios as he gets ready to travel the world looking for fossils. We'll talk about all these fascinating extinct animals then. I'm Carlos Frias. Thanks for listening.
WLRN Public Media.